Second case, Fort v. SunTrust Bank.
Good morning, Your Honors. David DeVito, along with Stephen Corin, on behalf of John Fort, Chapter 7 trustee and appellant. May it please the Court, the issue at the heart of this appeal concerns the proper characterization of the relationship between the debtor, IPG, and the defendant, SunTrust Bank. The record evidence, which was required to be viewed in the light most favorable to the trustee on summary judgment, establishes that that relationship, in which IPG was totally reliant on the services and systems that it received from SunTrust, and its day-to-day operations were intertwined with the SunTrust relationship, that evidence establishes that the relationship was far more than ordinary debtor-creditor relationship or lender-borrower relationship.
To what?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
No, you have to.
Oh. To what extent was that relationship, to what extent did it extend beyond the boundaries of the contract between the parties?
In a number of ways, Your Honor.
You don't make any claims of breach of contract. This is all negligence related.
That's correct. Negligence and breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honor. And there's certainly a contractual overlay here because there were, I think, 7 or 8 contracts between the parties governing the various services, systems, technologies, software, things that were provided to IPG by SunTrust. But the point is that...
I guess a corollary to Judge Duncan's question would be, what duty was there on behalf of the bank that went beyond their contractual duties?
Well, I think it's clear under both negligence principles and fiduciary duty principles that there was a duty based on their understanding of the reliance and the extent of the overlap of the relationship. For example, to consider the fact that by doing what they did, they were putting a company out of business. And so to put specifics on it, it would be a duty not to kill the company when they come and report to you voluntarily an internal theft at the company. So you know that if you pull the plug on this company, this company that has put $650 million through your bank in the last 3 years.
Wasn't this company contemplating bankruptcy already?
Contemplating?
And I believe, as I recall, that had had that there had been discussions with attorneys about bankruptcy. And it's interesting, the characterization that it killed the company would seem to be attributable to the undetermined embezzlement that IPG had suffered rather than SunTrust's discontinuation of trading, as I believe it was, on the online platforms at that time.
Well, I think all of those questions go to causation, which you'll notice that neither one of the courts below went anywhere near causation. There's no conclusion that the company was already going to go bankrupt. And in fact, companies consider bankruptcy all the time, and that's a voluntary choice that they make. But here, SunTrust's actions left no company left the decision a fait accompli because...
So it's not correct that when Burgess met with SunTrust officials to report that FAF, is that how you pronounce it, had stolen an unknown amount of money, explained that he did not know whether others were involved in the theft or whether others who had access to IPG's passwords for SunTrust accounts and that he had retained bankruptcy counsel and might have to shut IPG down?
Most of that is accurate in terms of what was said. But there were a lot of conversations between Burgess and the bank, and the company was still and could still be operating. And certainly to the extent that there's a dispute in the record there and that there was no conclusion by either court below.
Dispute about those statements being made on January 29th. 2008, immediately before.
No, I don't think there is a dispute about it. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, not a good idea to interrupt. Do you have any questions?
Well, My understanding is that Burgess first finds out about the embezzlement on January 16, correct? And he doesn't even advise the bank, as far as I can tell from this record, until the 29th. That's 13 days have passed. Would you agree that that's the fact in the record?
I know that there was a time lapse between, but I don't think it was a material time lapse.
Well, a lot can happen in 13 days if somebody has access to passwords, for example. But going back, I don't think you ever actually answered Judge Duncan's question about the what is the basis for your claim that there was a special fiduciary relationship or a special duty of care beyond the contractual obligation on the bank's part? Where is the evidence in the record that the bank was doing anything other than opening accounts, doing routine monitoring of the accounts, that sort of thing? Where is that in the record?
The evidence in the record, Your Honor, is that the IPG worked with SunTrust and its employees on a daily basis. They're in constant communication, and SunTrust knows that the services that it provides to IPG are integral to its operations.
Doesn't that put pressure on them, frankly, when they are told that a chief officer, what the CFO, has been embezzling funds for a period of time and has the access to these accounts, and that Burgess doesn't even know how much else FAF had done? Don't they have an obligation, in part, to protect their own client by trying to minimize any further harm by cutting down access to any of the accounts?
Well, one, they didn't have the unilateral right to do that under all of their agreements. Two, that's a disputed issue in terms of what they thought they were doing and whether there was any risk. Because if you look at the record, there are a number of internal SunTrust assessments where they characterize the risk that they were facing as a result of this relationship as essentially non-existent and fully secured by collateral. And I'll point out, which I think is critical, that in fact,
relationship to establishing a special duty for fiduciary purposes or altering the contractual relationship that usually exists between bank and customer into some sort of a negligence-related duty?
Well, I think they're sort of two separate questions and sort of in the sense that one is breach and one is duty.
Stand down for a second. What I think all of us are looking for is an evidentiary basis in the record for either one of these claims. So that would be helpful if you could point us to that.
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at the case law about when can a duty arise on the part of a bank to one of its clients, and it says, well, the ordinary relationship is debtor-creditor. So what's an extraordinary relationship? Well, if your baseline of ordinary is what you see in the case law, a loan guarantor, someone with a checking deposit, a deposit account, an IRA account, those are ordinary relationships. This relationship had a situation where this business was fully dependent on everything that was provided to it by SunTrust. SunTrust went and opened accounts at banks all over the world solely to service IPG.
But didn't IPG tell them which banks they wanted? La Caixa Bank in Madrid, as I looked at those emails, that suggestion came not from SunTrust. SunTrust wasn't giving them advice and saying, here's a good bank in Madrid that you might want to use. Your client was, IPG was going to SunTrust and saying, well, how about opening an account at this bank? So again, where is the evidence in the record that SunTrust was giving maybe the kind of financial advice that might establish a fiduciary relationship? I don't see it in this record.
Your Honor, I don't believe that advising is the only way for this relationship to transform from purely contractual to either a negligence duty or a fiduciary duty.
Well, what other ways are you pointing to? And you also said that SunTrust had no unilateral right to do what it did, but I would refer you to JA 658, which is a contractual provision which gives SunTrust the right to discontinue or refuse to offer you any account, service, or product at any time. So that would certainly seem to be a unilateral right to do what it did.
Your Honor, that provision, if I'm not mistaken, is in the deposit account rules and regulations, which governs only the deposit account relationships.
Okay.
There are a number of other contracts, including the online treasury management agreement and the software license agreement. One of those requires written notice of termination. The other one requires 30 days advance written notice.
Wasn't notice given orally to Burgess? Under the circumstances when passwords were outstanding that Mr. Burgess could not even account for, would not the actual notice be preferable to the 30 days notice provided for in the documents you referred to?
No, because the point of those notice provisions is in recognition of the interconnectedness of this relationship, that you can't just grab, the IPG couldn't just pick up its accounts and walk across the street and restart its business. They were entitled to notice of this termination so that they could keep the business running.
They did get notice. It was just oral rather than writing.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you can't find a case anywhere that says the written notice is satisfied by not written notice.
By actual notice?
Yeah. That reads the word written out of the contract. It's a simple, plain language analysis. The case that the district court relied on for this notion of substantial compliance has nothing to do with written notice. It's a case about a real estate contract where someone was trying to get out of it by saying that, well, the contract required me to hand a check to the seller, and in fact, I handed the check to the seller's attorney at the instruction of the seller's attorney, and they said, well, no, we're not going to let you out of the contract for that.
You've mentioned case law. I didn't see a whole lot of case law supporting your position that the bank had a fiduciary relationship. Can you point us to some clear authority that indicates when a bank has a fiduciary relationship to a client such as yours?
Sure. South Carolina case law is admittedly a little scant. I think the best South Carolina case on the point is the Steele case, Steele versus Victory Bank. That's a case where and I think, Your Honors, if you look at that case, the party suing the bank there was a whole lot more ordinary of a customer than IPG, and yet the court said that there was a triable issue on fiduciary duty. If you look at some cases that we cited from Florida and Kansas, there's a case called Linden Place, there's a case called Capital Bank.
We have to apply South Carolina law, don't we?
Yes, you do. And I think South Carolina law would be consistent with all of these cases in terms of the statements in the South Carolina case law say, well, if the relationship is ordinary, then pure debtor-creditor, no duty. But if it exceeds ordinary, then duties may arise.
What are the examples where they have found that it exceeds ordinary? That's what I'm looking for.
Well, the Steele case seems to me a much simpler fact pattern, and that is a woman gave some money to someone to purchase CDs on her behalf at the bank. That person who she gave the money to was known to the bank as a disbarred lawyer, and basically as a result of that created a special relationship based on the knowledge that the bank had about the reliance that was being placed on this shady character, if you will, and that created a triable issue as to a breach of fiduciary duty. Unfortunately, the South Carolina cases don't come anywhere close to this fact situation, but I think the principles, look, the statement in the district court's opinion that really is most troubling is this notion that, well, you weren't a typical bank customer, but the character of what you were doing in those accounts is the same as an average depositor. An average depositor does not have a policy exception from the highest levels of the bank. The Anti-Money Laundering Committee of the bank blessing this relationship, which is otherwise prohibited by the bank. The bank won't do business with money service businesses, but they
sophisticated relationship than Joe Doakes depositing his paycheck into the bank account, into his bank account once a month. But it's still the bank tendering services for which it offers no special expertise in return. It's not the trust department administering an estate and exercising discretion on the purchase and sale of assets within the estate that's in its control by virtue of being a fiduciary. I mean, as I understand what the bank and the company did in this case, they offered certain services related to international cash transfers, but they didn't give any advice to the company on how to trade, what currencies to deal in. You know, that was their business. They just gave them a platform that they could have sold to any other comparable client that wanted to use it and qualified.
Well, I'm not sure I fully agree with that. I think in addition to just providing the platform, they provided employees, they provided constant daily service so that whenever we called, because there were parts of our business that we could not conduct without talking to them about it. In other words, we don't know whether you've received customer money in some of these accounts. We don't know whether you've delivered money to our beneficiaries overseas. So it's not like, and as a matter of fact, they weren't offering to do this business for just old anybody. In fact, the bank has a policy that it won't do business with companies like this, but it wanted to do business with IPG because the relationship was extraordinarily profitable. And I see that my clock is running out. So for those reasons, we ask you to vacate and remand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have some time on rebuttal. Ms. McWilliams?
May it please the court. I'm Susie McWilliams, and my colleague, Jenny Claverius, have the privilege of representing SunTrust in this matter. It's been going on 10 years now. The genesis of this appeal is a traditional contractual relationship between a bank and its customer. And as Judge Agee noted, there is no breach of contract claim here. Instead, the appellant invites this court to create a tort under South Carolina law arising from the contractual relationship. Yet, there is no such tort under South Carolina law. I mean, it is well settled in South Carolina and in other states that the courts have declined to impose tort duties on the traditional bank-customer relationship, except in very rare instances. Courts in South Carolina have held no duty to an investor in a Ponzi scheme allegedly carried out through the services of the bank, no duty to a guarantor where the bank loans money to the son's business, no duty to explain a guarantee, no duty to purchasers of property on which the bank owns a lien, no liability for the enablement of imposter fraud by the issuance of negligently issued credit cards. There is a case in South Carolina, and we cited it, in which the court recognized tort liability on the part of a bank, and that's the Murray v. Bank of America case. And we cited that case because it supports our position. In Murray, an individual had a lost driver's license, an imposter comes and sets up a checking account and begins writing checks. When the customer finds out about it, she comes to the bank, speaks with a vice president of BOA, and says, close the account, and I need you to also tell these merchants that this is a fraudulent account. Bank of America waits 30 days before they eventually do something. Well, SunTrust didn't wait. SunTrust did what BOA failed to do in the face of a customer coming in, and this was not a simple casual call from Mr. Burgess. He runs in frantic state and says, there's been an embezzlement, as this court has previous, as Judge Duncan, you asked about. The fact of the matter is, SunTrust acted promptly. It ended the online access. There were passwords out there. Mr. Burgess had no idea who else might be involved. And so in that instance, if the court were looking at the distinction between Bank of America and SunTrust, SunTrust did what it was supposed to do.
And what about the argument, though, that the IPG makes that they needed information, they needed certain records to try to minimize the damage, the relationship with the customers, et cetera, and that the bank was slow in getting that information to them or got it to them in a format that apparently they couldn't use?
Well, there are two answers to that, Judge Brinkema. First, SunTrust gave to IPG every month written statements for both accounts, the direct deposit U.S. dollar account and the foreign currency account, every single month. And what did the IPG people do? They filed them. They didn't do anything with them.
And that continued even after this announcement about
You recall that on January 29th, when Mr. Burgess comes in, he tells the bank, I've stopped trading. He stopped trading. The access was only temporarily halted. Within 4 days, IPG was able to look back at all of its records. It had the paper records, but to the extent that it needed to look online. And so that, Your Honor.
Trade after that point.
I don't know if it could have. It didn't. We know that Mr. Burgess told the bank, he goes to Mr. Graham and says, you know, I'm going to have to reinvent myself. I've got to start over. And that's exactly what he did. And it's in the record.
Order on a comptroller currency or somebody that told him to stop.
That's correct, Judge Agee. And I think Mr. Burgess has, in some of his emails, told his other traders, I think, the FBI has told me to stop, or the Secret Service has told me to stop.
And what was the temporal, when did that happen vis-a-vis the bank's online, cutting off its online, its trading platforms?
Well, what we know, Judge Duncan, is that this is according to what Mr. Burgess tells the bank, that from the record, Mr. Paff goes missing and at some point is discovered missing sometime in the 13th or the 15th of January. The internal, I dare say not auditor, but someone who was brought in to help Mr. Burgess look at the books says, I think you're missing money. And then finally, once Mr. Burgess has arranged for Mr. Paff to be arrested and the Secret Service or the FBI, whoever it is he's dealing with, to try to get to the bottom of it, then he comes to the bank on the 29th. And the service is halted. SunTrust doesn't deny that, but in the face of what it was told, we submitted as appropriate. And then within 4 days, what Mr. Burgess then said was, well, we want to be able to look online and figure out which trades may still be out there, that we need to unwind those deals. And SunTrust literally worked for hundreds of hours, provided, again, the same written monthly statements that IPG had gotten every single month, never looked at, never reported an unauthorized transaction, never questioned at all. And so I think this is probably the crux of why the answer to whether or not this court should create a new tort is no, is that the SunTrust acted reasonably. Now, it sounds to me like, and if you read the appellant's brief, what they're arguing about is technical notice. They're saying, well, yes, you could have cut it off, but you should have given it to us in writing. They got actual notice.
That's a breach of contract claim.
And it's not in front of this court. But I would note for the court, and I'm sure the court knows this, the appellant brought a breach of contract claim, and he had it accompanied by a fraudulent act. The bankruptcy court found no evidence of any fraudulent act in cutting off the access or any of that. And so recommended it be summary judgment be entered. Judge Hendricks at the district court agreed, and there was no appeal. So if this were a breach of contract claim, then maybe there would be some toehold for the appellant's arguments. But the fact of the matter is, there was no, there's no evidence of any damage. What IPG had done was cease trading. They started trying to figure out how to pay back the money that they had for the to be able to recall any transactions that could be unwound. And in fact, as the record shows, Mr. Burgess was already reinventing himself. He did. He was setting up FX transfers. It's the exact same business, using the same software he used when he was IPG. He's in business today. He uses Fifth Third. He had that going almost immediately. But
In the record,
yes, Judge,
I was noting that there was an email from IPG on February 1st. So that would be 2 days. It's at 301, in which it stated that according to Burgess, regulators and law enforcement have ordered IPG to stop all transactions until the full extent of the fraud is determined. So there would really only be those 2 days when the online access would have made a difference?
I think that's correct, Judge Duncan, but that also, you would have to assume that they were also going to continue doing business, which Mr. Burgess informs the SunTrust officials in Greenville when he runs in, hair on fire, saying, whoa, you know, stop, I've got an embezzler. But there were no such transactions. This might be a different case if, in fact, and it was, and then there was a breach of contract claim before this court, if, in fact, there had been some huge transaction that should have closed and should have, you know, would have had been bigger than $250,000 because that's how much we know at least Mr. Paff stole. But just assuming that, but there's no evidence in the record of that. In fact, what the record shows is that this business failed because it had a huge embezzlement, and then it otherwise commingled the funds from its customers and paid out its salaries, commissions, bonuses, car payments for Mr. Burgess and his wife. The fact of the matter is they were not operating in an appropriate commercial manner.
I think of all of Mr. DeVito's proffers of information, the one that he focused on to a considerable extent to support the argument that there was a special relationship is the fact that SunTrust did not normally do business with money service businesses and required a special exception from their, I believe, antitrust department to enter into that contract with IPG. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Judge Duncan. What Mr. DeVito was, I believe, was referring to is there's in the record about 2 years into the relationship, under the Anti-Money Laundering Act, SunTrust was required to monitor these types of businesses. And in order to continue with IPG, it required information from IPG about whether or not it was trying to monitor its own practices to avoid against money laundering. And so the documentation that was put together in June of 07, now 7 months before the embezzlement's discovered and the business basically stops, it is true that SunTrust was continuing in its obligations to comply with federal law to make sure that it was monitoring such businesses. But the fact that the SunTrust decided to continue with this business based on the representations from IPG, if you look at the record that they said, oh, yes, we've got our own anti-money laundering. We use a security business to monitor these transactions. That still does not change the relationship.
Were there other exceptions to the policy that SunTrust granted? Or is it in the record?
It is not in the record, Judge Duncan. But I don't think if one looks at the paperwork.
That's fine.
Okay.
I just was.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And of course.
Counsel cited a case. I've already forgotten the name of it.
Steele.
It's the Steele.
And opposing counsel says that's a basis in South Carolina law to find a either extra contractual duty or the basis for a fiduciary relationship. Can you respond to that? Tell us a little bit about that case, why it would not apply here.
Yes, Judge Agee. The Steele case involved a active fraud of which the bank became aware. And the court ruled that there may be a question of fact as to whether or not the relationship between the depositor and the bank became more than the traditional one. And it was based on the bank's knowledge. I would submit that that's consistent. I don't know. I confess, Judge Agee, I don't know whether on remand if a fiduciary duty was established, but that is actually consistent with the Murray case as well. Because in each instance, the bank has absolute direct knowledge, actual knowledge of fraud that has been reported by its customer, and it takes...
It fails to take action.
In Murray, it failed to take a step, and there was a question about that as well in the Steele v. Victory Bank, which is a bank actually that ended up the whole thing.
You had said earlier that, in fact, SunTrust did not want to be in the position of Bank of America. Once they were put on notice by Burgess that there had been this embezzlement and, again, this obtaining of passwords and the concern that there might be other monies taken, it seems to this court that it put an immediate obligation on the part of the bank to cut off any possible further access until the situation could be better understood.
I think that's exactly right, Judge Brinkham. And the other questions that have been put by this court as to what is there in the record that changes the relationship. And again, if the court looks at South Carolina law, there's nothing in this record that changed the relationship between IPG and SunTrust. Now, the suggestion that they were dependent on the bank to be able to conduct their trades and that sort of thing, I would submit Nixon Pruitt. My law firm is dependent on our banking relationship. We have conversations with them. We can't get our bills out. We can't process payments when our bills go. We need our bank, and our bank, but the bank retains the right, and just like SunTrust did here. It's a contractual relationship, and that's all it is. But to suggest that the mere fact that a depositor or a customer needs the bank in order to conduct its transactions, I mean, that doesn't change the relationship. And I would,
Can the trustee argue that the relationship actually changed on January 29? That is, up until January 29, this was simply a debtor-creditor, normal kind of banking relationship, except it was a big client. But on the 29th, doesn't the relationship possibly change? Because at that point, the bank is now put on notice of this problem. Does that create a special obligation now on the part of the bank? How do you handle the problem?
Well, Judge Brinkman, that's an excellent question. And I think that under the rationale I've put forth, that actual knowledge, it is true that the bank knew at that point there was a tremendous risk to IPG, to the bank, with regard to possibly millions that had been embezzled from this customer, but the record is also clear. It's not refuted that what SunTrust immediately started doing was helping the customer figure out, and they spent hundreds of hours not only recreating all the paper records that IPG, for whatever reason, had not maintained, but it restored access within 4 days. And so, again, since we are traveling in what the plaintiff claims is a negligence cause of action, or breach of fiduciary duty, then the bank's conduct gets you, this court can review it, and was it reasonable under the circumstances? If we were solely talking about a breach
but
of contract.
But I'm sorry, but is that then a question of fact, which would say that one should not grant summary judgment? And is that not why the bankruptcy judge recommended not granting summary judgment?
Your Honor, I think the summary judgment is appropriate because the bankruptcy judge only says the relation. She never makes a finding that as to the timing that you have raised, Your Honor. What she says is, well, I think the relationship was something else. But beyond that, this case is not any different than the reason there was liability in Murray was that the bank failed to do what the customer wanted. This bank SunTrust did not fail to do. So there's not a question of fact. And if, again, You're going to travel in negligence, which we submit. There's no duty here. There's absolutely no duty, but there's no breach, and they must also establish or raise some question of proximately caused damages. And I would just call to the court's attention the finding of fact of the bankruptcy judge. It's it's finding of fact 87, and this is not disputed. You have heard nothing from the appellant. It's not in the appellant's briefs as well, but what Judge Judge Burris found was that from the time that in January of 08 to this day, IPG has never been able to keep track of its expenses, its profits, its losses, because of its own poor record keeping. And respectfully, if this court were to say, well, I think there might be a question, as Judge you have raised, with respect to the whether or not a fiduciary duty was created, there's no evidence, none, in the record. In fact, I would submit that.
So you're saying there's no evidence in the record that any damages flowed from the way in which the bank handled the closing of the accounts.
That's right. And we would admit that they had a contractual right to do it. So you can't convert into a fiduciary what you had a contractual right to do in any way. We had the right to stop doing business with them, but we did not. SunTrust spent hundreds of hours for the next few months working with IPG. The account was not closed summarily. It didn't close until sometime later in the summer. By that time, IPG had reinvented itself. Mr. Burgess was over there at a company called FX Transfers, was going to town. He does go ahead and put the company into bankruptcy in June of 2008. But the fact of the matter is, they live and die by what the bankruptcy court found in the findings of fact. And Judge Burris specifically says, to this day, they cannot say what their, I'm sorry, it took me a minute to find it, but cannot say what its income, expenses, or profits, that's damages, should have been because it failed to keep adequate records. Not SunTrust, not the denial of the temporary denial of access to the online trading platform, but... And I see I'm about out of time.
You can complete your response to Judge Burris.
All right, thank you. But it was IPG's failure. And I could have, and I think the record is replete, I would have, had I had more time, gone through with the court the numerous defects that again, the bankruptcy court found in how IPG transacted its business, which led the court to that conclusion. All right. Thank you very much. And we would obviously urge the court to affirm the summary judgment below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DeVito, you have some rebuttal time.
Is the Steele case cited in your briefs?
I couldn't find it.
I don't believe it is. It's cited in the district court's opinion.
Okay, I didn't find it. I just looked and I didn't find it either in the reply.
How do you spell that, Steele?
Steele. I believe that it's versus Victory Bank.
All right, thank you.
And just to follow up on a point related to that, I think if you look at the South Carolina law on the issue of duty, they make it clear that the existence of the duty is not necessarily based on the foreseeability of the harm, in other words, what the bank knew, but it's based on the character of the relationship. And so that's where you get the principles that, well, where you exceed the confines of the ordinary, that's where the duties arise. Now, I'd like to respond quickly to something Judge Brinkema said, and that was, well, on January 29th, 2008, perhaps the relationship changed. What should you have done? The answer is change the passwords. That's what everyone had agreed to do when Burgess went to the bank. In fact, the bank prepared the paperwork to change all the passwords. And he, Burgess signed it, and they were going to change the passwords, and that was the simple answer. It was only after that the bank met internally and then issued the shut the company down directive, and that's what we submit was the breach of duty.
But there could be no transactions anyway, according to the IPG email. IPG had been instructed not to engage in any transactions. So I'm struggling with two things. First of all, I've never understood you to identify something that takes this relationship out of the contractual. And given the fact that IPG could not engage in online transactions anyway, what did SunTrust do that, in your words, killed the company?
I'm not sure that it's undisputed that they couldn't engage in transactions. What's
going specifically on the email from IPG? That was IPG's email I read from.
Yes, I think that's what the email says. But until SunTrust pulled the plug on the ability to conduct transactions and the ability...
That was before. You're talking about January 29th, and the email was February 1st or 2nd.
In terms of the timing, yes, but there was no reason why they couldn't continue to conduct business.
Except that they weren't.
Your own evidence.
That's what an email said on January 13th. Certainly, I believe there's a conflict in the record. And
you can't defeat summary judgment with a conflict in your own evidence.
I don't think that email that you read from, Your Honor, says definitively that the company could no longer conduct business. And I think there's other evidence in the record that says they could.
According to Burgess, regulators and law enforcement have ordered IPG to stop all transactions. I just don't see anything ambiguous about that.
At that moment in time?
On February 1st.
Okay.
Well, is there any evidence in the record that the FBI or anybody else authorized them to start having transactions again?
No, I don't think there's evidence either way. But I don't think that the FBI was clearing or not clearing their ability to conduct business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel and take a short recess.